Session number 6125, reel 5.
Mr. Hale, tape 5.
So we pointed our rifles, our Bren gun and our Thompson machine gun at these individuals on the verge and gave out the classic challenge, halt, who goes there? We didn't have to wait very long because they turned and fired at us. I can recall now what they must have actually been doing. They must have been putting a signal point down, because I remember seeing them with signal wire or wiring of some sort in their hands. But they turned and fired at us, and we opened fire at the same time. The fire came very, very quick, very, very heavy at us. My machine gun used its drum up, and I yelled at every man for himself and saw the two men and followed them right over the side of the cliff. And we spun over and over, and I rolled right down to the bottom. I could feel or hear the firing still going on. Got to the bottom, turned right, and run across what was a type of paddy field, rather hard, baked, but it was kind of a hard mud field. And I got a very sharp pain in my shoulder, in my neck and shoulder, which blew me right off my feet. I knew I'd been hit. And the firing was still going on, a few bullets round me as I lay. And then they stopped firing in my direction. I could hear them still firing, and what sounded like a return of fire. And I got to my knees, and I had to run to the roadway and turn left. Then I got onto the metal Castle Peak Road, and I ran, for all I was worth, straight back along the Castle Peak Road. Nobody fired at me from the time I lay on the ground, the time I got up, turned left and ran. And I tore along the road, and I came to what was a bridge that had been blown. So I clambered up all over the earth and a roadway that was by then touching the branches of the big trees that were overhanging. So I clambered over those, and there were still wires running. I could see the wires running into the culverts on either side of the bridge. I didn't know whether any more was to be blown up or not. However, I got over safely. By then, I was all covered in blood on my left arm. Blood was dripping off my fingers as I was running along. So I don't know, of course, how badly I was hit, but I was losing quite a lot of blood. But I still managed to jog trot along the road, and the sea came very close to the past Castle Peak Road at one stage there, and there I could see a gunboat in there, in the harbour, which was quite close to the road. And I called out to the gunboat, and they answered. And I told them that the enemy were landed at the Hong Kong Brewery. And the gunboat, she pulled away and went towards the direction that I came from. I continued my run over two or three more broken down bridges or blown up bridges until I was within shouting distance of a bandsman or a band corporal who was on the other side of what I could see were laid mines. He recognised me after threatening to shoot me. His rifle came up, and I shouted out, identify myself. He said, well, I'll see you through the mines. So he saw me through the minefields and put me onto a little three-wheeled tricycle that they had there, and he set me on that. I was in pretty bad shape then, I think mostly with shock, possibly, and loss of blood. And he pedalled me up to the place I'd left battalion headquarters. The adjutant and the commanding officer, Colonel White, met me, and I reported what had taken place, and they seemed quite pleased. They sent for the medical officer. He came and took me in an ambulance down to the British Military Hospital in Kowloon. and I underwent treatment, superficial treatment there. I had a blood transfusion, and later in the evening I was evacuated to Bowen Road Military Hospital on Hong Kong side. And later that evening I was taken into surgery, and the surgeon remarked to the his colleagues, anaesthetists and what have you, in the surgery or operating theatre, that I was the first gunshot wound that I had to deal with in the present conflict. And they extracted a bullet from my left arm. And I came out of the operating theatre and ended up into the ordinary surgical ward. And if you remember, I said earlier that my young lady, who I had a very close understanding with, was working in command headquarters, and that she had to do some nursing as part of the war work that she had to do when she got called back from Manila on the death of her father. Well, I let it be known through a friend that I was in hospital, and lo and behold, within an hour, she was on the ward, my private and personal nurse, as I thought. Her mother arrived to wish me well, and also her two sisters, so I wasn't short of visitors on that day. And of course I kept my girlfriend with me. She had downed pens or what have you at command headquarters, and then decided that nursing was to be her vocation for the remainder of the war, particularly all the while I was in there. Well, the day wore on, and there were no more war cases came in that I was aware of into my war that I remember. I had one or two appendix cases were in there, which they turfed out very, very quickly and sent them back to the firing line. But I remember dozing off, and there was a terrific crash, and it appears that the Japanese had started shelling Hong Kong. And one of the first shells that landed in the end of the Bowen Road Military Hospital, in the end of the ward I was in. So the aircraft had been over quite a bit, bombing the reservoirs, and word came that we were all to be evacuated from the wards down into the shelters which were below the hospital in the cellars. And my nurse, Anne, I refer to her by name, Anne, she came with me, and we went down into the cellars underneath, and we lay there all for hours, all evacuated down there, and quite a lot of bombing was going on. And it was there, and whilst I was under there in fear and trembling, that I asked Anne if she's prepared to be married. And she was, and I suppose that's where we were really engaged there. And that was, of course, one of the most memorable things that happened to me about that time. But another thing that stuck in my memory, a Canadian sergeant crept in under there with us, and he said, "Care for a drink, something to eat?" I said, "Certainly would." And he said, "Well, have a load of this. I've had all I want, and there's some drink to follow." And he unwrapped a bag which contained bacon sandwiches on bread. Really wonderful, because we had nothing to eat. Anne and I tucked into these, and he followed up with brandy and dry ginger. Lord knows where the chap had got it from, but trust the Canadians, at any rate, they always did themselves pretty well, what little we knew of them, because I hadn't been in Hong Kong very long. But we had the bacon sandwiches and the brandy, and ever since then I've had quite a yen for bacon sandwiches and brandy dry. Well, I wasn't in hospital very long, a matter of days, and a Lieutenant Price was an RAMC man. He had been, he was an old China hand. I think he was a medical missionary up in North China, and he had been recruited into the Royal Army Medical Corps. He was quite elderly, as I thought in those days, possibly even late 50s, early 60s. But they gave him a couple of pips, and he examined me in the ward, and he thought that I was fit to rejoin the unit, as they were very, very short of men. It meant going out with my arm in the sling, but the wound had healed, or was healing nicely. He had the old soldier's idea of sniffing a wound to smell if there was any corruption, and I can remember Lieutenant Price sniffing the wound to see if there was any corruption, and he said I was fit to go. So I said goodbye to my girlfriend, goodbye to the ward, and was put in an ambulance and taken down to the town, from Bowen Road down into the town of Hong Kong, left to find the unit. Well, of course, I didn't know then where my unit was, because I knew that the Royal Scots had been evacuated from the mainland in company with the Rajputs and the Punjabis, the other two battalions that were over there. via the grapevine, I knew that they were back in Hong Kong, so it was my duty to try and find them. So I went along to our old barracks, Murray Barracks, which was practically deserted. I think there was a medical corps person just occupying the medical corps building, and he told me that the battalion was now, the battalion headquarters were up at one of the gaps, either Wanchai Gap or Wong Li Chong Gap. So I had to find my way up there. But before I did so, I went along to the Chiu Ho Club and had, well, I suppose, which was my last real civilian meal. They always gave us a very good meal, very cheap. Steak, eggs and chips was a favourite meal, and that's probably what I had then. And an MT driver, one of our Royal Scots driver, came in, driver of a 1,500-weight truck, and immediately got talking and asked him if he was going anywhere near battalion headquarters, and he said yes, he was going up with an empty truck, and it was arrived for me if I cared to come. Well, we had our meal, got in the truck, and away we went up to the, I think it was Wanchai Gap. And as soon as we started going up the hillside towards the peak, towards the gap, we started getting shelled, and we were shelled nearly all the way up. They were bracketing us, one in front, one behind, and the driver varied his pace, and we eventually turned the corner at Wanchai Gap, landing me right back on the battalion headquarters. Well, I was given quite a nice welcome by the commanding officer, and the headquarters officers were there, and he filled me in with what was happening. And he said, well, as my flipper was still in a sling, there wasn't very much I could do in the way of handling a weapon, but I was to go along to the orderly room and await events. Well, stuff was coming over at us from the mainland. Pretty thick and fast. We're getting shelled and bombed quite a bit. And I was sent for and told that they were going to put in an attack over the Wanchai Gap, and I was to lead a section of Canadians. Well, in the course of the day, the Canadians and I set out. We went up, crawled up the side of the gap. Well, I'd seen previous sections going up without too much success, and I went up with six men, and we got up onto the top, just over the brow, and we got into a slit trench. Unfortunately, the Canadians were absolutely untrained. I had to show them how to load their 303, and none of them had any aiming practice. They were absolutely useless. And we found out what we thought were a pocket of Japanese, open fire, and we hadn't got a few rounds off, and they started mortaring us. They used, I saw later, their little 2-inch mortars. They opened fire and started shelling us pretty heavy. And They bracketed us, and I bent down below the level of the trench to pick up some hand grenades, and we got two direct hits. There were three others in the trench with me. They got hit in the back, or I imagine they were hit in the back. One got very badly hit, not only in the back, but in the neck. I had my hand on the top of a sandbag. I lost two fingers and was badly lacerated all over the top of my hand. But the very fact that I happened to be bending down as the mortars arrived, I feel saved my life. We yelled out for stretcher bearers. They came up. They left one of the three. He was dead. They took the other two and myself. They guided us down to an advanced dressing station. Those two Canadians died at the advanced dressing station. My hand was dressed, tourniquets put on, and owing to the state of the shelling, it wasn't until nightfall that I was evacuated down through the gap again, down through Garden Road, past where the Peak Tram was, past an ambulance that received a direct hit, and I was taken directly into... I was taken from the advanced dressing station down to Bowen Road Hospital. I put in another appearance in the surgery, or the operating theatre, where they gave me local anaesthetic in my fingers, and they started cutting back on my fingers, and I said, for God's sake, put me out, I can feel everything. And the surgeon said, well, how are we off for anaesthetic? And the anaesthetist, I remember, said, I think we've just got enough. They put the mask over my face, and next thing I remember coming to, and the surgeon saying, well, you won't feel this anymore until they take the dressings off. And I sat up on, or they helped set me up, and I was promptly vomited all the tea up that had been given me at the advanced dressing station. It made a right mess of their operating theatre. And the surgeon said, that's the trouble. And the advanced dressing station, they push hot, sweet tea into these people, think they're doing a good thing, and we clear up the mess. I can remember him saying that very, very well. And the surgeon said, well, I understand you are the pianist, of the garrison pianist of the Royal Scots. Yes. He said, well, we've endeavoured to save as much of your fingers as we can. We've kept the nerves to the top of your fingers because the further we cut the nerves back, the more will be the shrinkage. So we've endeavoured to leave you as much of your fingers as possible, but the tendons in your hands are badly damaged, and how they're going to work out, we don't know, but the best of luck. You'll be evacuated to the Hong Kong Hotel, which is being used as a convalescence hospital. Well, later in the following day, I think it was, it's a bit of a job after all these years to remember quite the sequence of events, but it wasn't very long after I had the operation to tie back my fingers that I was evacuated to the Hong Kong Hotel. And that's when we came into Garden Road, because they were shelling all movement of ambulances, trucks and everything. Coming down Garden Road, past Peak Tram and my old barracks, Murray Barracks, there was an ambulance that received a direct hit. We didn't stop. We went over mattresses, pillowcases and whipped down Garden Road, turned left into Queen's Road, and drew up outside the Hong Kong Hotel, where I played for and had done and spent many very happy evenings under the grips, which was the dance floor of the Hong Kong Hotel, and that was all covered in mattresses, all spaced out, and they were the convalescence beds, and I remained there until the surrender. There was a few trained nurses, but it was there Mimi Lau, who was the subject of an earlier discussion we had. She'd been one that was caught up in the the trials and tribulations of the building of the air raid shelter. She had been on the big fiddle, and I mentioned before that she caught up with me, and she did. I'd said goodbye to my girlfriend, who was still nursing in Barron Road when I left, and I never saw her again and have never seen her since. I managed to keep in touch with her all whilst I was in the Hong Kong Hotel, hoping that she would come down to the Hong Kong Hotel and join the nursing staff that was there, but she never did. But I did get one or two parcels to her and one or two parcels from her whilst I was in the Hong Kong Hotel. Her two sisters managed to come in and see me on one or two occasions. But that was the last time I saw Anne, was when she waved me goodbye in Barron Road. whilst we were in the Hong Kong Hotel, things were getting pretty bad in the town. We were hearing on the grapevine that water shortage was very bad. The food in the Hong Kong Hotel began to deteriorate rapidly. The refrigeration went off owing to the loss of the China Light and Power. There was little in the way of electricity, so the food began to get rancid. Although it was in the month of December in the colder part of Hong Kong, food began to get go off, meat rancid, and we began to get some idea of what prison camp life was perhaps going to be all about. The surrender went on Christmas Day, and we understood that the Japanese were not taking any prisoners, and of course we wondered very much what our fate was going to be. We never saw any Japanese on the Christmas Day, but on the Boxing Day, three Japanese came walking around the beds, heavily camouflaged, one with a machine gun, a somewhat similar type to a Thompson submachine gun, pointing at the various beds, and the other two soldiers had drawn revolvers pointing. They walked around bed, and looked at each person on the bed, but did nothing, and as far as we could understand, never said anything, at least not in English. But we still didn't know what was going to be the outcome. We learned later that all the personnel in the Stanley Hospital had been murdered in their beds. The nurses had been raped and killed. One of those nurses, out of all the nurses that were raped and killed, one was saved. She was an older woman, and she had sense enough to cough and explain to the Japanese that she got TB. So they used her to further their ends with the other women, and she managed to get to the Hong Kong Hotel. How on earth she got there, I really can't remember details. But she had brought us the news of what had happened down in Stanley. So we were all very much on edge.
Had you had any official preparation for being taken prisoner? Had you been told what to do?
No, because as far as we were given to understand, the Japanese were not taking prisoners. We didn't take Japanese prisoners, except on one occasion at a Repulse Bay Hotel. Some Japanese were taken prisoners for a time and put into a lock-up garage. But they, I believe, were shot by our own people. But as far as we knew, we just hoped that the Japanese would take prisoners. We didn't really know whether they were signatories to the Geneva Convention for what it was worth. But we thought our chances were really 50-50. Probably depended where you happened to be at that time. We learnt subsequently of various happenings, to what happened to some of our pals in various pill boxes, but they were given very short shrift. If you a good resistance was put up, the Japanese had no hesitation, but when they overran the places and took them, to kill off all personnel, whether they put up a good show or whether they didn't. So the spirit of Bushido, where they honoured the good fighting soldier, and they would give them their freedom, didn't obtain. They just gave them the farewell with a bullet, the same as they were quite prepared to accept themselves, on the understanding that a dead Japanese, just his spirit just fought on, and they were quite prepared to shoot any British soldier or Canadian soldier that they or Indian soldier that put up a good resistance, and say, "Well, here you are, here's your bullet, go on and fight on." I mean,
life. So you must have all been pretty worried on the.
We were very worried, and we were hearing stories after the surrender was coming in. There was a certain amount of running between Bowen Road Military Hospital and the Hong Kong Hotel. The Japanese would on occasion allow transfer of badly wounded people from the Hong Kong Hotel back up to Bowen Road Military Hospital, which hospital the Japanese were quite prepared to accept as the one and only British military hospital. And as far as their training and spirit allowed, Bowen Road Military Hospital continued to function as a hospital, to a certain extent a limited capacity, because I believe drugs got very scarce, or what they would allow drugs into Bowen Military Hospital, Bowen Road Military Hospital. But by the changeover of people, we learned what was happening. Certain people were brought from Bowen Road Military Hospital patients back down to, or down to the Hong Kong Hotel, and they brought us stories of what was happening. We knew that there were assembly points, and that the remains of the garrison were being, or military personnel and the dockyard police were assembled on our old parade ground at Murray Barracks, and were taken across to Sham Shui Po Barracks on the Kowloon side, and that the civilian personnel, the remainder of the men, women and children, were billeted out into various brothels. Nursing mothers had no milk for the babies because of the lack of water. What little water there that the Chinese were able to obtain, they were selling to